The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
Get your hands out of my pocket. I know what happens if you regularly put your hands in my pocket and think that what's in them belongs to you. You're going to think that everything belongs to you. And lo and behold, that is the curse of the modern era, where, again, we have printing presses, which create an inflationary bias, and which also conveniently continue to increase the tax take by the U.S. Treasury.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, gold's had a great run here. I mean, we started around 1050 here a couple of months ago, and now we're up past 1250. But there's still this anxiousness amongst gold owners, guys who followed gold down over the last few years and have heard that it really had nothing to do with people selling gold. It had to do with manipulations in the paper market, what we call the short guys.
Yeah, I can imagine a prisoner of war who's been slapped around so many times that every time he looks at his captor, he just expects something painful to happen again. And he kind of winces, just, oh, not again. Right. And the gold market has been very unforgiving for 3 years. Liquidations through the ETFs, definitely short pressure if you're looking at the commitment of traders and growing short commitments. That is, people who are profiting from the downside.
Right.
And we've mentioned that something significant changed in January. And what changed was the ingrained belief that the central bankers actually do hold the sun, moon, and stars in place. And perhaps that's something that's not quite fitting for their job description, not quite fitting to their skill set.
Well, and as long as that belief was there, you could have the Goldman Sachs and the Merrill Lynch's dump paper contracts in the market or sell gold that they didn't even really own. You know, I noticed the contract market got to the point where there were over 400 ounces of gold being sold or purchased on paper for every 1 ounce that actually existed. We've never seen anything like that before, but that's happened in the last month.
Well, and not just existed as in out there in the universe, but was deliverable on those contracts,
right,
as in existed on COMEX. So, you know, what was actually deliverable was a scant number of ounces compared to what was being traded.
But for every short, every time you sell something short, that has to be covered at some point. And aren't we seeing short squeezes not just in gold right now, but we're also seeing it in iron. We're seeing it in copper. We're seeing it in areas that we thought were going to go down forever, it seemed.
Well, and that's where the squeezes have been the most dramatic. I mean, iron ore this last week, oil, the stock market, there has been some significant movement higher as people who've been short the market have had to cover, been inspired to cover being on the wrong side as the price starts to move against them. Gold is a little bit different in that it's not entirely a short squeeze that's driven the price thus far. The amount of ounces that have been bought through the exchange-traded products, which we'll talk about in a little bit, has been considerable. And that really does represent a sea change. After 3 years of liquidations, 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 now you have purchases, purchases, purchases. And this is not a game. This is actual metal that has to be set aside and is taken out of the system, which is intriguing. So when I say there's a sentiment shift, this is people changing their minds about the extent to which central bankers can control economic outcomes. And that has changed because the evidence shows that it should change. The evidence shows that actually QE has not created a tremendous amount of economic growth, whether it's in Europe or in the United States. Actually, negative rates continue to disappoint both in the European space, but also in Japan. And you have Kuroda who's being asked the question, is there more that you can do? Well, yes, he can take rates even deeper into negative territory. But these are, again, are indications to the average investor that yesterday we thought they had it well in hand. Today, we believe that they have challenges which cannot be addressed with the tools they have in their toolbox.
Well, and I hate to say it, it's causing some indigestion in Wall Street, Dave. You know, people remember the movie Wall Street where Michael Douglas went, you know, on lunch. As long as the markets are doing what they're going to do, let's go have a little steak tartare at Tavern on the Green, you know? And, and the Manhattan restaurants at lunchtime especially the steak restaurants, are full of stockbrokers who are just assuming that the central banks have things under control. The volatility index, if you recall last year at this time, we talked about the unusual certainty that was in the market. Why not go to lunch? The central banks have got our backs covered. That seems to be changing. These guys are missing lunch here a lot more than they'd like to.
And most of your big steakhouses, whether it's Bobby Vann's or Delmonico's, Sparks, Smith & Walensky's, just to name a few, they're more and more empty at lunchtime, according to a Bloomberg article, which, you know, it's not an article that's saying paleo or a protein-specific diet is out. It's that this massive decline in lunch visits in the city has to do with people wanting to stay at their desks. They need to stay at their desks. And, you know, volatility has increased. You've had radical intraday swings, and they're being generated by high-frequency trading algorithms. And your lunch out may cost you more than the tab. It may cost you your job. It is a trader's market after all. And you've got guys, take for instance the Goldman Sachs this week cutting 5-10% of their fixed income and Forex group. Who wants to be the guy that's away from his desk when consideration is being made as to who stays and who goes? So lo and behold, this job insecurity on Wall Street plays itself out in this form. There's no more two martini lunches.
So those blue crab cakes that you had at the Writer's Inn might be the last big lunch that you have before you pack your bags. Well, you know, it's not just happening with lunches. Volatility is also increasing the awareness of banks to just go ahead and pull some money out and increase their cash positions. You know, there seems to be a mentality right now, not just amongst commercial banks, but even central banks in Europe. Let's go ahead and raise our cash.
That's right. The commercial banks like HSBC, who for their clients are saying, I quote, economic trends continue to drag lower. Mm-hmm. And they're not particularly interested in increasing risk and sort of quote unquote buying the dips. They're concerned enough to be bumping their cash allocations from what was 6% to what is now 17%. In our view, they're headed in the right direction. The report, which they published this week, says that cash is king in a world with overhangs, specifically debt overhangs. And the concerns are, as the report reads, unless corporate earnings start to turn up, there's very limited upside for economically sensitive assets, such as equities.
Well, and it's not just HSBC. I mean, it's JP Morgan as well. JP Morgan seems to be looking at the stock market with sort of a wary interest at this point.
Right. The recommendation is that on any bounce in price, if the stock market should rise, you should be selling stocks into that strength.
Yeah, but Goldman Sachs continues to say, bye, 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 bye.
Well, I mean, that's what I hope they're saying someday to their clients, because I wonder why they still consider it a privilege. That is, their clients consider it a privilege to be a Goldmanite. The sentiment, you're right, it's JP Morgan saying, look, we have a looming risk of crisis, a looming risk of recession, the worsening outlook of economic growth. It is corporate earnings, which year over year are looking very ugly, and we don't see that changing anytime soon. So right. If you do see strength in the stock market, again, this is not a time to be enthusiastic unless you're enthusiastically selling.
Okay, but the system that has worked so far has worked mainly because of monetary printing, quantitative easing, things that we talk about come from the central banks in the form of monetary policy. Dave, you've been predicting over the last few weeks that we're probably going to see some effort now towards fiscal spending. In other words, if you can't print it and if you can't make it happen by lowering rates, then what you do is you start spending on a government level. And that may not, in an election year, show up here in America, but it seems to be happening north of us.
Well, and I think it will show up as soon as 2017 here in the United States. And yeah, you know, the new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, is reversing the priority of Mr. Harper and that administration of keeping a balanced budget.
You're talking about Canada.
Yeah. And the problem here is that, yes, you're seeing slowing economic growth. And this is what JP Morgan's looking at. This is what HSBC is looking at. This is not just the United States. And certainly you can march out a number of economic statistics which say, oh, no, the U.S. economy is in recovery. But look at the top four trading partners. Canada, China, Mexico, and Japan are all deteriorating economically. If they are the top trading partners for the United States, how is it possible that we are growing while our top four trading partners are in contraction? Again, if you're wanting sort of extra evidence, it's just not there.
But it is an election year, Dave, so we are going to see growth numbers. We're going to see better employment numbers. I mean, we've talked about this every election
year. As statistics are massaged.
Exactly.
You know, later this year, I'm going to introduce a gal who's written a fascinating book on GDP, and it's basically a study of how GDP has been constructed through time. I know that sounds very boring, but the point is you get to see how political that particular number is. Mm. And when someone has the opportunity to benefit from a better printed number, you know, who is that person and how did they actually influence it? It's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating story. And that's something we'll bring into the commentary later this year. But back to Justin Trudeau, if he's not wanting to balance a budget, what is he wanting to do? He wants to spend money that the government doesn't have. So government spending is coming, deficit spending is coming. And the intriguing element here is that world leaders are witnessing the ineffective economic response to negative rates, both in Japan and other places. And for the first time, they're questioning the limits of monetary policy.
Wow, what a surprise. What a surprise.
The reality is politicians would like to see the benefits of monetary policy. And when they don't, guess what they have? They do have a scapegoat. They can always turn on the hand that has fed them and say, look, these guys just have not done their job. Now, we will have to make up for lost time. And if monetary policy doesn't work, then fiscal policy must be pushed. And the inclination is to, quote unquote, do something. And that's what they must do. That inclination is just too great.
Well, you've used that as an example. You were a goalie growing up. And, you know, goalies, they've found, you criticize the goalie if he does nothing, but a lot of times that's the best thing that he can do. So he has to jump to the right or he has to jump to the left at some point, right?
Right. I played goalie in hockey and lacrosse and soccer.
Right.
Glutton
right.
for punishment.
Right.
And there is this inclination to move. And the art of the offense is to deceive the goalie as to where you think he's taking you. And most oftentimes, if you just stood fast,
right in the center,
you've got fancy footwork to deal with, or, yeah. or the handling of a puck in such a way that it looks like he's going to get around you, and there it goes right between your legs. It's an inclination that must be fought.
So this need to do something, we talked a couple of weeks ago at the Bridge to Nowhere that we have here in Durango.
Politicians have to, and it's infrastructure projects.
Right.
And that serves as the road which Trudeau is going down, and I think other politicians are as well, of putting money into the pockets of the middle class. That's what Justin said he's going to do. Via these infrastructure projects, we are going to put money in the pockets of the middle class. And I suspect the state side infrastructure here in the United States, these projects could very well start with helicopter pads in every major city.
Oh, you've just been ruined by Ben Bernanke, okay? You're just thinking helicopters all the time. You have more cash from the helicopter.
How do you get money to the people who are going to spend it?
Right.
Not only can we do the infrastructure projects, but then we can have direct delivery. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not helicopter pads. Maybe it's what we need for drones. Amazon's going to perfect it, and maybe they can be our cash delivery service.
Okay, but let me ask you about inflation, because we've seen monetary policy fail while they printed trillions. I mean, not just Canada, but we've created trillions of new dollars that really have not gotten into the economy. They've gotten into asset prices. But wouldn't this be an inflationary push?
Well, that's the issue, isn't it? Because money in the hands of the masses is far more likely to be circulated through the economy. So that issue of dead velocity, that issue of velocity staying tame as they've printed trillions, all of a sudden is reversed. And so money to the masses may likely have more of an inflationary effect than they were anticipating or hoping for. 2% is what they hope for, but we'll see how that translates as they try to put a chicken in every pot. That sort of approach to monetary and now fiscal policy stimulus, we'll see if they don't in fact get more than they hope for. 2017, in any regard, promises to be a very fascinating year. And if you are, as an investor, on autopilot financially, and you're not concerned about this transition in monetary and fiscal policy, you know, that speaks really to a desperate political need to grow the economy, which is one of the things we talked about with Tomasz Sedlacek last week. This ingrained belief that we must grow, grow, grow. Then you're in trouble. And this is a point that Robert Higgs made on our program several years ago.
Yeah, he called it the Leviathan. The Leviathan has to continue to live, and for it to continue to live, it has to grow. And for it to grow, it has to spend deficit spending.
Well, and so what he calls the Leviathan is what we know as the state apparatus,
yeah.
And it will feed on whatever it must in order to survive. And that's in the form of financial repression or negative rates, a form of financial repression. That's just one type of feeding. You've got engineered inflation. That's another type of feeding for the state apparatus. You've got the redistribution of wealth via fiscal policies. That's yet another way that Leviathan feeds. And the transition is now immediately in front of us. We have fiscal policy, which is meant to buttress the grand monetary policy experiments.
Right.
And Trudeau is just the man who happens to be giving a voice to it. But by 2017, when we have a new president, he's the first, he won't be the last, to say we need to, quote unquote, invest, which is really a politician's euphemism for deficit spending.
Well, and Tomáš Sedláček last week brought up a great point. He said, you know, we're not against capitalism. Capitalism is just fine. But the problem is growth capitalism is almost like a false religion, the belief that you always grow, that things always get better. And that expectation seems to come into the political stream. I mean, Trudeau's just responding to what a politician does, and that is promise continual sunny days.
Right. Well, economics professors, maybe Tomáš is a notable exception here, they insist on proposing the same things over and over again, even when results are disappointing. Mark Faber is always providing a wide range of, to me, very historically interesting quotes, and he brings Goethe into the mix this week. I quote, "Such people continue in error because they are indebted." This is speaking of sort of the professorial type. "Such people continue in error because they are indebted to it for their existence." Mm. They would have to learn everything over again, and that would be very inconvenient. How can their experiments prove truth when the basis for their evaluation is false? They do not prove truth, says Goethe, nor is such the intention. The only point with these professors, he says, is to prove their own opinion. They are perfectly satisfied if they can prate away empirically.
Yeah. And you know, Dave, you brought up something to the group here just a few hours ago when we were meeting, that for the person who does want to come in and balance the budget, let's say we have a presidential candidate who comes in and balances the budget. Well, he immediately puts us into a depression, of course, because we're living on life support right now. The economy has to have this deficit spending or we have absolutely no growth. You brought up an example of the central banker right after World War I in Czechoslovakia, who came in and did all the right things with not too great of an outcome for him, but the economy itself and for Czechoslovakia, they were the beneficiaries of a great policy that ended up getting him killed.
Well, that's right. Alois Racine was the man responsible for taming inflation post-World War I and bringing about some economic stability in Czechoslovakia.
But it took pain to do it.
Well, the problem was what he implemented created a recession.
Yeah.
And that was necessary in order to sort of clean the system out. And within 24 months, the economy was rip snorting in growth. I mean,
right.
it was the right thing to do, but the emotional response of people who are impacted by that, we're talking about an emotional response. We're not talking about a rational response. Oh, this will be fine. When people experience pain, they react. And that pain response to Alois Racine was, I will feel better if you are dead.
And they assassinated him.
Doing the right thing. I mean, I think there's only one candidate who would do the right thing and attempt to balance the budget. I think that's Ted Cruz.
Right.
But you know what? Ted Cruz would put us in a greater depression doing what makes sense to you and me in terms of economic policy. Pursuing a balanced budget, trying to sort of clean up this mess and this debt addiction that we have, I think he understands the issues in play. The problem is, since we're talking about a teetotaler, which I believe he is, the problem is a teetotaler is not the person you need for counseling someone who's trying to get off of an alcoholic addiction, because that teetotaler might give them advice that kills them.
Right. Well, and the people just don't seem to want it. So let's just go ahead and say infrastructure spending, deficit spending will probably be a part of whoever the next president's attempt to please the people
Well, that's because the economists on both sides of the aisle, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, whoever makes up the president's economic council, they subscribe to this idea of smoothing the business cycle.
Right.
And so, yes, at this point, infrastructure spending will be a part of the next U.S. president's attempt to do that. Smooth the business cycle, promote growth, and it is a critical tool that will be used to respond to the next round of economic crisis. And our challenge is rest on a faulty thesis.
Which is what Sedlacek pointed out as a continual growth expectation.
That's right. We must have growth. We must continually push for it by any means, whether that's debt, whether that's inflation, or anything else that enables us to live at a level we think we deserve, which is actually beyond our means.
Dave, isn't it amazing that periods of deflation in history have shown that sometimes that's when the most money actually gets into the pockets of the middle class?
Well, it's ironic and it's fascinating to me. I read a Bank of International Settlements paper this last week, and it highlights all of the instances of deflation going back about 300 years. And it's fascinating that economists pick on the 1930s deflation here in the United States. And if you look at the panoply of deflations that we've seen in the historical economic record, that's the one that doesn't fit any of the others. Which one does not look like the others? And yet that's the one they refer to always
is the 1930s.
As the test case for what we should learn from deflation. Because in fact, the irony is that the great periods of deflation, including the one just prior to World War I, a major period of deflation, it was full of growth. You had real wages which were on the increase. In fact, you were flirting with deflation for a better part of 100 years in England and then in the United States as well. And in David Hackett's book, The Great Wave, he highlights how real wages were on the increase from 1800 to 1900. This was a period of monetary deflation, which subsequent historians and economists have written off as particularly harsh. You have swings in employment. When don't you have swings in employment?
Right.
But what was actually happening is that it was incredibly generous to your average tradesman. You had an increase in real wages, which is an increase in household wealth.
Right.
The problem for central planners, primarily in the 20th century, and this is a 20th century problem, is that wage increases, because they are in the form of decreasing prices paid for the things that you want, it's not taxable.
You're right. So if the economy looks like it's shrinking in monetary value, the tax intake is lower, even if you're coming away with more in your pocket.
I don't know that anyone's ever pointed this out, but 1913 was when we created our central bank and started running the printing presses. 1913 is also the year we created the income tax. We did not have an income tax prior to 1913.
Which means they could guarantee no more deflations as long as they could print money.
Well, and this is a question of who deflation is good for. It actually was good for the tradesman whose real income was on the increase. Not necessarily good for those who would be indebted. Not necessarily good for the banking system. But the debate over income tax in this pre-1913 period was fairly intense. The New York Times in 1909 says this: when men get into the habit of helping themselves to the property of others, they cannot easily be cured of it. I mean, the discussion was, get your hands out of my pocket.
Right.
And I know what happens if you regularly put your hands in my pocket and think that what's in them belongs to you. You're going to think that everything belongs to you. And lo and behold, that is the curse of the modern era, where, again, we have printing presses which create an inflationary bias, and which also conveniently continue to increase the tax take by the U.S. Treasury.
And you wonder where that, hey, we have to have 2% inflation comes from.
So deflation is an evil to be fought with no elements to it at all. And our modern economists look at the 1930s as the only period of deflation as a test case. And as it stands out, according to that study by the Bank of International Settlements, it actually is the anomaly. It is the one period of deflation which is unlike every other period of deflation theretofore. So we're going to explore this more fully in the months ahead. But I love what Faber published in one of his recent research reports. It comes from Michael Leibowitz, and it shows a point of departure between our economy and the massive levels of debt which over time have accrued. Anyone want to guess where that gap begins to appear, where our debt levels are increasing dramatically more than our general economy is, or GDP is?
Okay, so at some point, what you're saying is there is a time when debt increases and GDP increases, and they're somewhat stable together. Okay, and then there's a time when debt just increases.
Exponentially, yeah. Relative to the size of the economy.
Hmm.
From 1968 to 1980, this period is where, if you're looking at the chart, you see a radical departure. Let's call it the 70s and 80s.
Isn't that interesting? That's just about the time that the Bretton Woods system fell apart. I mean, we went off the gold standard in 1971.
It's not without coincidence that that was the last period of transformation in our monetary system. That is, the end of the Bretton Woods Monetary Agreement. 1971 was the formal date, but you had deterioration throughout the late 60s, which preempted the Nixon administration's quote-unquote temporary, it was supposed to be, temporary suspension of the dollar gold peg. In the next month, we do want to explore the transition in the global monetary system and the transitions we anticipate in the near future to this global monetary system. We're going to invite Harvard political economist Jeffrey Frieden into that conversation, along with Michael Pettis, who's been a guest on the program before, who has tremendous respect for Jeffrey Frieden's work there at Harvard.
Well, and like Barry Eichengreen, these guys have input into the people who are making the decisions about the next monetary system.
Well, and our discussion with Frieden is going to center on which monetary systems cater to which political constituencies. Mm. And we're going to explore who in the 21st century will receive preferences and why.
And this has been his area of expertise. I mean, I think he's one of the only guys who's written concisely about this.
I think the political debate over money will in our day be as contentious, be as spirited as any we've seen in the past, due to the extreme benefits of a particular monetary system, which are conferred to a particular group in society. More than ever, we are very aware of the extreme nature of rich and poor. We have this wealth imbalance, and it's been exaggerated by our central bank monetary policies.
And we're seeing it with Trump and Sanders. I mean, we're seeing the anger toward that. It is the issue of the day.
Right. Those two people reflect a middle class revolt, if you will, from right. The establishment party lines, and they're just flat angry. Part of what they're angry about is this radical departure of the common man's wage from the super rich. And it's the same kind of political rancor that we saw in the days of the robber barons. And I'm telling you, the conversation will ultimately center on the nature of money and the monetary system that we have, as it did in previous generations. Because remember, when we went through the period of determining whether or not gold was going to be central to our monetary system, or gold and silver, a bimetallist system,
right.
Silver was wanted by your export community and your agrarians, people who are running farms. Why? Because silver was inherently inflationary. There was more of it, and you could inflate the monetary system more easily with it than you could gold.
Right.
And so with that inflationary bias, there were people in the economy who benefited and therefore wanted it. And lo and behold, do you know why the gold system was chosen? It had to do with stability being favored by the banks on Wall Street.
Unusually, we don't have that anymore.
And to be honest with you, I prefer the gold standard, not because right. I'm a banker, but because I prefer stability.
But they wanted stability.
Well, that's right.
Well, and that all boils down to balance of payments. Now, we don't have to
You're
get
exactly
too complicated,
right.
But you know, when you have gold, if you spend more than you have, then you have to ultimately balance payments with the real stuff. Now, let's go to a different issue here then. There was a time, Dave, when the decision was made to start going into debt in this country. We were the largest creditor nation for hundreds of years, several hundred years. Then we became the largest debtor nation quickly. So there was a time when you went $1 into debt and you got $1 worth of growth. Okay. But you pass that period of time and then you start going $1 into debt and you get less than $1 in growth. So can you give the progression a little bit of how that works?
Well, this is back to the previous issue that Leibowitz was highlighting in his research. Is it coincidental that our debt problem began to accrue starting in about 1968 to 1971?
As the gold standard started falling apart.
We started with debt and GDP running at equivalent levels. By 1987, a short time after the gold paper money disconnect, our total outstanding credit, that includes private, corporate, and governmental debt, had reached, this is again by 1987, 150% of GDP. 10 years later, 1997, we're at 250% of GDP.
What that means is for every dollar in growth, you're spending $2.50 in debt.
10 years later after that, we've got 2007, nearing 350%. And I think by 2017, we'll in all likelihood exceed 450% of debt to GDP. Again, we're talking about total credit, which includes private, corporate, and governmental. This is the trend since 2000, taking in sort of a rolling average. Since 2000, in order to grow the economy, we have averaged an increase of $4.47 of new debt to achieve $1 of economic growth, that is an extra dollar of GDP growth. So I think of the Goethe comment and realize that although these numbers are unique to our circumstance and story, the cause is not unique. People with ideas write history, for better or for worse. And the ideas that are writing our history are worn out. They have been for at least 40 years.
Yeah, they're going to probably still dust them off and try them again. I mean, like you said, they're going to deficit spend some more to build the infrastructure.
So you've got the Trudeaus of the world who will continue to pile on more debt as a quote-unquote stopgap measure. It's not stopgap. It's the whole story. It's what has driven our and the global economy in a growth mode in recent decades. It's excess liquidity flowing here, flowing there. But that excess liquidity has grown significantly because debt and liquidity are today one and the same thing.
Well, it reminds me of what Sedlacek said last week. You know, GDP is really not gross domestic product. It's gross debt product. Okay, so let's go ahead and talk about payroll taxes, okay? The Labor Department is going to continue this year. We've already talked about it being an election year. We're going to see numbers that are questionable, but are they real?
Yeah, there is this curious case of flat payroll taxes, even as the Labor Department boasts of new jobs. I mean, think about that. So you've got a rising workforce, an increasing workforce, which should mean there's more people getting paid, which means there should be an increase in payroll taxes. And yet, this was pointed out by Jim Rogers this last week, this is a brain teaser. How do you have payroll taxes not rising at the same time that the labor market is improving?
Right.
So again, you have to look at these government statistics and say, what? I mean, is this like a creative writing course? The question posed by Jim Rogers this past week was, what do you do? What do you do with payroll taxes? It's inconsistent. And he was suggesting this in the context of saying, basically, there's 100% chance of a recession in the next year.
Right.
Do you consider the jobs numbers from last week? When you look at them, yes, there's reason to hold them suspect. We have January numbers now. We also have February numbers now. And what you normally expect is retail carnage following the Christmas holidays. So how is the Labor Department reversing what has been a law of the jungle? If you're talking about retail, you know, where you hire people in late November and early December, you know, staff up for the holiday season, where you make 75% of your money in retail.
Right.
And then you lay them off in January and February because those are your slow months. And yet the Labor Department is telling us that you have not a diminishment in retail jobs in January and February, but an addition of 55,000 retail jobs in February. And that's after an increase of 62,000 jobs in retail in the month of January. So this is where, you know, if it looks like a fish, if it swims like a fish, if it smells like a fish, maybe it's fishy.
Maybe it's fish. Well, you know, shifting to China just for a little bit here, because China doesn't seem to apologize about watching its people, controlling its people. So in a way, it gives us a good chance to see the direction maybe we're going to go. You know, Snowden, when he came out, he revealed what the NSA was gathering on us. We've already heard that Google, their whole goal is just to accumulate any bit of information. They don't care how it's going to be used. They just want to control all information. We interviewed a year and a half ago, or about a year and 3 months ago, Nazli Chokri, who was an expert at how the borders between countries are falling because of the internet. And, you know, she said there's only four outcomes. One has to do with freedom, but the furthest on the fourth outcome has to do with complete loss of freedom.
You've got to listen to that. If you haven't listened to that interview, go back to December, I think it was 2014.
Was it?
and listen to it because she's well-spoken.
She didn't have an agenda.
No,
she
just said,
look, let's look at this as a fact.
And I think added a lot of value to this conversation about information control. It's China now who is setting the newest standard for statist problem solving using big data. And the statist problems that they want solved are unique.
It's the Chinese Google, but it's going to be applied to watching the people, but pre-crime, basically, like the movie.
When Big Brother meets big data, what do you have?
Right.
And this is a platform that euphemistically they're calling a united information environment. I'm sure many of our listeners have watched the Tom Cruise movie Minority Report. Bloomberg this week wrote about the Communist Party in China empowering the largest state-run defense contractor. They have about $25 billion U.S. in revenues. This is the China Electronics Technology Group. They're developing a software application for pre-crime.
Before you do it, they'll know before you know.
That's right. And they're going to know what actions you're going to take of a terrorist orientation as they link your bank accounts, your jobs, your hobbies, your consumption patterns, footage which they collect from surveillance cameras, web traffic activity, social media data, along with, of course, the secret file that they keep on almost every Chinese person called the Dang'an. I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly, which contains your work permits, your health records, your school reports. In select cases, it even has personality assessments, and of course, all the data points which are kept on record collected from neighborhood informants. They combine this, they analyze it with algorithms, and it helps them predict terrorist activity. It helps them identify subversives.
You know, it really does. It sounds like the movie. And, you know, you said you may be mispronouncing it, but I'm thinking that the American translation, if you call it the Dang'an in China, I think it's the dang it here in America. I don't want them to know that.
Well, it's the Laboratory of Human Control and Coercion, which has been newly inspired and upgraded with the latest technology and the latest technological toys. Now, I realize that it was the last Clinton administration which shared missile technology with the Chinese, but I wonder if it's the next Clinton administration, which looks for a little quid pro quo, a little reciprocity, and wants the algorithms for themselves. We know the FBI, the NSA, would no doubt keep such software from being abused. I mean, they respect our constitutional rights. We know that for a fact. You can trust the government. We know that for a fact. And certainly on this side of the pond, we have great confidence in the ability of our government to take a vast amount of data and never, ever, 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 ever abuse it.
I know I've brought up my Amazon Prime account, but I'm watching how society's evolving around Amazon Prime and around Google. And I can see it even in my own account. The other day, I ordered a couple of books that were sort of out of character of the group of books that I've ordered in the past. And it was amazing how the recommendations had changed. You can imagine if the government's watching that and saying, huh, has he got some new ideas?
Speaking of new ideas, I can't tell you, I loved the conversation we had with Tomasz last week. And it did put a dent in my bank account because from Amazon, I ended up with about two boxes of books. My favorite
See,
part
you
of,
have that weakness too.
Well, of course, but yeah. My favorite part of any book is a bibliography where I can ask the question, if I appreciate what an author is writing, what informed their thinking on that topic? Who did they read? How did they come to these conclusions? And so the curiosity trail goes deeper and deeper and deeper and wider and wider and wider. And sometimes you end up reading stuff that you're like, I don't know how it fits in, but lo and behold, you do find ultimately value added in terms of the way that books have influenced other authors that you respect.
Well, Dave, and I'm going to reveal something I hope you don't mind me revealing to the listener, but there's three things you do when you read that I think should be imitated. One is you rewrite the book while you're reading it. You don't own a book that you've read that you haven't completely marked up and written in. That's number one. You know, number two is a lot of the guests that we have, I'm like, Dave, where do you come up with the guests that we have? A lot of them come from bibliographies. They come from books that you've read, that you read the bibliography, you ordered the book, and then you talked to the next person down. That's a great second way to do this. And then third, people say, well, where did he get his vocabulary? Including me. I have to go look things up sometimes after we do a show. It's like, what did he just say? But at the end of all of your books, on the last page of the book, any word that you encounter as you come across that word, You write that word in the back of the book, and you make an effort to actually add that to your vocabulary. I've always appreciated those three aspects of the way you read, and I think that would be a good practice, actually, for any young person listening to this show. Start marking in your books. Start looking at the bibliography and ordering other books. And if you come across a word that you don't understand or you've never heard before, write it down and learn it.
I think most people are familiar with the concept of active listening, where you are engaged at a deeper level in a conversation with someone. And it's difficult to have a real conversation with a lot of the people that we do read. Because quite frankly, a lot of the people who have written the books we're interested in, they're dead.
Right.
So how do you listen actively as you're reading a book? That is an active reading posture. And so, yes, I have two different pens. I usually have two pens in one hand, a red and a blue, and I'm writing different notes relating to different things in the margins. But there is an active listening which you can bring into a book, which allows you to get a lot more out of it, remember a lot more of it, own it, and you, in essence, have had a legitimate conversation with the author. Versus a more passive approach of, I think I remember this and such. Maybe he was talking about this and such. I debate the author oftentimes.
Well, and it's not just a book, Dave. You read a lot of newsletters. You read a lot of reports. Okay, let's take Jim Grant. Okay, you have an active conversation with Jim Grant, both personally, sometimes when he's on the show, but you have a very active conversation with him in his newsletter. Bill Gross, okay, shifting back to the economy this week. I know that you appreciated what Bill Gross had to say.
And his comments, I think, are spot on. As we're talking about debt and the limits of debt, I was fascinated by Bill Gross's comments this week as he says, look, decades of credit expansion, they've come to an end. Let this sink in. And we've said this before.
That's our whole paradigm, Dave.
I know. If we are at the end of a multi-decade credit expansion, what are the implications for money? What are the implications for investors? What are the implications? I mean, if this is the case, he suggests banks are permanently damaged. And we will not return to pre-crisis 2008, 2009 levels. And as we discussed earlier, there's only so much debt that an economy can carry before growth slows, before growth goes negative, or you start the write-down process where you begin to have to wipe out some of that debt. And that deleveraging event is what the financials, specifically your banks and Wall Street firms, have long feared. And it's also what the central banks have fought with every tool in the box.
Well, and this brings me back to how we started this program. You know, one of the fears that gold owners or future gold owners have is the control that so far has been, you know, exercised in that market, in the paper futures market. But the investor market now is the swing vote, isn't it? The investors are coming in, they're saying, no, I'm not buying contracts. Go ahead and give me my gold. I mean, look at the ETF gain in tonnage of gold just in the first 2 months of this year.
Yeah, the predictable sources of demand, you know, China, India, primarily jewelry demand, you know that 2,500 to 3,500 tons per year are going to disappear into those pockets.
But you can count on that every year.
Right.
Right.
Add to that some central bank demand, which has become positive since 2009. And that's an interesting trend in and of itself to think about, central banks accumulating gold after 20-odd years of getting rid of it. But then you've got this small segment, and it is the smallest segment, but this is where prices are made. Prices in any asset are made at the margins. If you have one more buyer, then you have sellers, then the prices are going up. If you have one more seller, then you have buyers, then prices are going down. So it doesn't take that much. In this case, it is actually quite a bit. After 3 years of net withdrawals, that is liquidations from the gold exchange traded products, you have inflows since January 1st of 259 metric tons.
That's 259 tons of coming off of the market and going into a vault.
That's right. That's the most since June of 2010. Investor sentiment has indeed shifted, and it appears that the cyclical bear market in gold is over. We continue to see consolidation of your year-to-date gains. I think we will over the next month or two. Typically, April and May are not the strongest months of the year for gold. To see us digest what we've seen since the beginning of the year would be normal. But I think as you head towards the fall, I think you see a continuation of growth trends, which takes us back to that 2001 to 2011 growth trend all over again.
Yeah.
Why is the world considering gold this time? It's a little bit different this time than in that 2001 to 2011 period. Certainly, there are economic similarities. We had more debt than we needed then, and we've doubled down. So that is a very real element. But on top of that, we have 7 trillion reasons why people are moving in the direction of gold. That's the number of dollars currently in negative yielding government bonds. Hmm. And there's going to be more added to that. There'll be 10 trillion reasons why people are moving to gold over the next year or two as we add to the number of negative yielding government bonds. And people begin to ask that question. Do I believe that the monetary mandarins of our day, the central bankers who have become our central planners, do they have this well in hand? Are they achieving what they told us they would in the real world economy via monetary policies? And to the degree that that confidence fades, thus you have a sentiment shift and a major adjustment ahead, a major adjustment ahead, not only in the gold market to higher prices, but also the stock market in equities to lower levels.
Well, and let's just talk about the stock market before we wrap up here, because there are many of our listeners that are still in the stock market and they're wondering what the levels should be this year or going into 2017.
Well, the current bear market in equities has been in place for over a year, and it's evolving into a similar pattern like we had in 2008, 2009, an initial decline which your pundits have categorized as a healthy correction. And of course, they've only categorized that after the fact. It's not as if they said, well, we need a healthy correction and should anticipate one.
Right.
Once you're down 15% to save face, you say, oh, it's a healthy correction. Don't worry about it. This is in the context of deteriorating market breadth. That's just a technical measure of buying and selling and the number of stocks that are doing well versus the number of stocks that are doing poorly. And there's far more stocks that are in a declining trend than those few standouts where investors have sort of clustered around and focused their energies. You've got a decline in market breadth. You've got declining earnings. You have a weakening economy, which all opens the door for phase two of the bear market later this year.
Well, and like you said, JP Morgan is saying, go ahead and sell into the rallies, are they not?
That's correct. You've got HSBC as well, what we spoke of earlier, increasing their cash position, preparing for what lies ahead, which in our opinion, if you're looking at the Dow Jones Industrial Average, is a sub 15,000 number with a shot to even sub 13,000 this year.
That's going to hurt some portfolios, Dave.
Well, definitely. And I think since January 1, what is fascinating, if you're looking at these market dynamics, this is absolutely critical. If you want to say, Dave, look, no. We had our correction. Now we, like Goldman Sachs, believe that the stock market's moving higher. Rip snortin', we'll have a great finish to the end of the year. Well, explain this to me then. This is what I would consider irrefutable proof that we have tough times ahead. As the price declined by 15% in the Dow and the S&P, it was with increasing volume. As we've watched this, what I would consider bear market rally, it has been on declining volume. And that is never the basis for a next move higher if you're talking about a bull market in stocks. You need to see a major rush to the entrance. And what you're seeing instead is a major rush to the exits. And then on every rally, just as JP Morgan is suggesting, it's being sold into, and there's not that many people who want to buy. So declining volume trends as stock prices increase, and increasing volume trends every time you see a downswing, that I think has to be paid attention to. It is a telltale of a bear market.
You know, last night we were out eating dinner and they had on the television one of the games that's moving into this March Madness, you know, one of the basketball games. And I couldn't tell whether the game was a biggie or not because I don't follow it that closely. But the cameras, and they shouldn't have done this, the cameras took a pan of the lack of audience. And I thought, well, these are two teams that nobody cares about. There were virtually no one in the seats except for the parents of the players. And and I said, well, go ahead and let's continue with our dinner. We'll watch something a little bigger later. And see, that's the thing. The stock market, we don't get a chance necessarily to see the pan of the seats, how many people are actually interested in what's going on. We just see the number go up and down. But what you're saying is the numbers, when they do go up, we're seeing more and more seats vacating.
That's right. And I think that's absolutely critical. The volume statistics are telling you what's next. So invest or divest accordingly.
All right. So we've talked about the stock market, talked about bonds. We try to cover these areas. We've talked about gold. We've talked about oil. little bit about politics, but what do you do on that? So what's your recommendation? We're 2 months in. We're actually in our third month into 2016. Where do we go from here? What's the recommendation to the person who's listening who'd like to have some sort of guidance?
You know, for anyone who's been listening, this is going to sound like Pete and repeat. If this is the first time you've heard us give a recommendation, then it may be fresh or refreshing. First, I would make sure you have an adequate store of liquidity. And what I mean by that is either cash or gold bullion. I mean, these are things that represent money and liquidity and allow you to prepare for what is next. I don't look at gold and silver as sort of a cul-de-sac where you go, you park, you die. It serves a purpose at some point. You will spend ounces, you will spend dollars. You don't hoard dollars for the sake of owning dollars. You have them for the sake of something else.
It's potential energy is what it is.
That's exactly right. So increase your potential energy now. What does that mean in practical terms? It may mean reducing an equity portfolio, an equity exposure. I think you must have some offset to the impact of both monetary and fiscal policies moving forward. So I see gold as coming back into the limelight in 2016, 2017, and 2018. I think we're back in the same kind of market moves that we had in that 2001 to 2011 period. There will be years immediately ahead of us where we have double-digit returns. If I had told you that last year, you would have laughed at me. To say it this year is just to say what has already happened in 2 months, not 12. And we could book our profits for the year and have had a very good year in these 2 months. What I'm saying is that as sentiment shifts and people are concerned about risks inherent to the global economy and how we grow from this point, I think you begin to see an allocation shift, a massive allocation shift, prioritizing cash, prioritizing gold, prioritizing low volatility and low risk. However you can define low volatility, low risk, and liquidity, I think is absolutely imperative. If you haven't done it already, the market may be giving you a gift right now. As JP Morgan suggests, you should be selling into strength.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.